This relates back to what you started with, and that is the Palestine exception. What Barnard College has been doing is actually writing new policy as a way to then retroactively decide that events are unauthorized or, in fact, do not follow procedure. And I think there's some really critical issues here. And one of the critical issues is how are decisions at the university made? A lot of these have been made unilaterally without consultation by faculty or students, and is in fact a violation of the university's own conduct guidelines. And clearly there's a tremendous amount of influence by trustees, administrators, alumni, and donors who are making decisions about what kinds of speech ought to take place on college campuses and what can and cannot be posted.
We're talking to Barnard College professor Pramila Nadesan. We want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Felt it was critical to get in that Gaza journalist. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual end-of-year campaign. You can help us meet our $75,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $20,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. Thanks so much for your support.
Support for the KBOO Evening News comes from KBOO members and Lori Sonnenfeld Realty, helping people buy or sell a home or duplex in the greater Portland area for the past 35 years. More information at CascadiaHomes.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. This is a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. I'm Althea Billings, News Director here at KBOO. From December 25th through January 1st, we'll be taking a look back at some of our best stories from the past year. Before we dig in, it is KBOO's end-of-year campaign, and now is a great time to support the radio station you know and love. Every weekday, we bring you local volunteer-produced news to inform your life. We train volunteers in radio skills and train them to gather news from our community. If you've enjoyed it this year, consider donating to KBOO if you're able. You can go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Well, we've got a few things in store for the next hour, but up first, my interview with Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden about his latest story. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, talking about his new story. It's the second installment in his series on Portland homeless services contractor Urban Alchemy. The article is titled Urban Alchemy's Million Dollar Lawsuit. Urban Alchemy settled a $1 million lawsuit days after Portland opened a UA-operated camp in July. The class action suit brought by an employee in California speaks to concerns about the organization's model. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So today we're looking at part two in your series on Urban Alchemy, but before we get to that, for folks who may not know, what is Urban Alchemy and how are they tied into the response to the homelessness crisis in Multnomah County?
Urban Alchemy is contracted up to $50 million with the City of Portland. It comes out of the City of Portland's general fund to pay them to manage the temporary alternative shelter sites. They also manage two of the Safe Rest villages, and there will be two more opening within the next couple of years that they'll be contracted to manage. Their goal of those sites, according to the city, is to get people into permanent housing. Urban Alchemy is not a service provider. They just manage the sites while other service providers come into the sites to work on case management.
So before Urban Alchemy came to Portland, they operated in California, and you write about one of the lawsuits they had to settle just as their first camp in Portland opened. What was that case all about?
Yeah, so there were some lawsuits that were reported, I think 6 lawsuits in California before Urban Alchemy came to Portland. And that was one of the concerns that a lot of local service providers had. I spoke with Kirkpatrick Tyler, kind of asked about that previous reporting. And he told me that if I dug in a little bit deeper, I would find that, you know, these are basically falsified stories. He had said that to me in the past in July. It was essentially fake news, and I wouldn't find anything. So I dug a little bit, and what I found relatively easily was that they actually settled a $1 million class action lawsuit that was brought in December of 2020 by an individual who worked at Urban Alchemy in California. This was on behalf of a class of other Urban Alchemy employees. It cited 9 violations of California labor law, saying Urban Alchemy violated unfair competition law, failed to pay overtime wages, failed to provide meal and rest breaks, didn't pay minimum wages, and then in addition to some alleged violations of California's Private Attorneys General Act, it's called PAGA, the labor rules in California.
Well, you also kind of give a breakdown of how a class action settlement works and what is meant by the settlement. It doesn't necessarily mean there's no admission on the part of Urban Alchemy for those kinds of allegations. Is that right?
Right. It is important to say that basically the agreement, the person who complained, held that there was merit to what they were, why they brought the lawsuit in the first place. Urban Alchemy said this has no merit. And then this is essentially the way of just getting out of that. There was a trial that was scheduled for February 13th, 2024. But rather than go all the way to trial, both parties decided that if they could essentially settle for, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 per employee, which ended up being $1 million, then they would essentially drop the lawsuit and not force Urban Alchemy to claim that it was guilty of these violations.
Right, and so that was about failure to pay and track overtime wages. What were you able to find out about how Urban Alchemy is doing in Portland compared to conditions in California?
Yeah, not a lot. One of the things that I mostly found is from people who live in the sites who are concerned about Urban Alchemy staff, who they say don't appear to be all that well taken care of as far as like sitting out in the cold creating some different sort of power imbalances and stuff that people were a little bit concerned about. In some ways for the concern for the safety and the health of the employees who are working there. I am continuing to dig into more specifics about, what's going on as far as Oregon labor laws. But at this time, this is sort of more about the fact that they did settle this lawsuit. And then when we're asked specifically about those lawsuits, they said that it was fake news.
So part of Urban Alchemy's business model is hiring people who were previously incarcerated, which is certainly admirable since people who've been in prison have a particularly hard time finding work after release. Can you talk about that aspect?
Absolutely. And it is really important to say that that is really important work. A 2021 Bureau of Justice Statistics report found that 33% of formerly incarcerated individuals in the U.S. found no employment over 4 years after their release, and no more than 40% were employed at a given time. According to this analysis by the nonprofit research organization Prison Policy Initiative, people who did find a job made an average of 84 cents for every dollar of the U.S. medium wage. So Prison Policy Initiative, also cautioned that harsh post-prison conditions can funnel formerly incarcerated people into the least desirable jobs, and often resulting in lower wages overall and more harmful working conditions. Urban Alchemy says that its workforce is made up of 96% formerly incarcerated or formerly homeless individuals. That's a huge part of its business model. That's obviously a huge part of addressing a serious need for people coming out of the U.S. carceral system. And Tyler says that these skills that people learn in prison give people without experience specific skills that make them suited for the job of working with vulnerable populations.
Well, you cover this in the article too, that workers who were formerly incarcerated may be more likely to face exploitation because of their past. What has research shown about that component?
The analysis from the Prison Policy Initiative said that commonly businesses have found a way to capitalize on the desperation of applicants with conviction histories to exploit the fact that they have less bargaining power to demand changes, less bargaining power to demand changes in the conditions of employment, such as better wages, benefits, and protections, which that power imbalance then, creates a situation in which people are stuck, maybe doing work for, much less than they might deserve otherwise.
Well, your article also discusses, and you alluded to this a bit, the issue of power and decision making in village style housing models, such as the ones that Urban Alchemy is operating. What is that structure like at Urban Alchemy sites, and what has local research found about people's preferences when it comes to decision making?
I spoke with people who have lived at these sites, and they, one in particular had that seems representative of a larger kind of culture. They overheard a person who, an Urban Alchemy employee, saying that they were complaining about how they weren't seen as having any power at the site, and the resident there told me that they felt that was missing the point. People are there to help people. This isn't supposed to be a power thing. I spoke with Marisa Zapata from the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative at Portland State, also called HRAC. They did a study in the 2022 report, and when they were going through that study, at first they thought people, of course, would just generally want to be in a village with a democratic self-governance model. What they found in surveying people at village sites is that 69% of villagers overall prefer to share in decision-making in a village, and only 26% that said that only villagers should determine what happens in the village. So a lot of people are perfectly fine having some sort of nonprofit responsible for running the sites. But as Zapata noted, people do still want a say, and they do want transparency about what is happening. And that seems to be kind of the difficulty and a point of tension here now, is the transparency.
Well, the article also covers a practice that I was unaware of, where workers are knocking on the doors or looking in the windows of each pod at least every hour, but in some cases every 15 minutes. Why do they do that? And what is the impact that that's had on folks living there?
According to Kirkpatrick Tyler from Urban Alchemy, they do these wellness checks every 15 to 30 minutes, particularly for people who might be struggling with substance abuse disorders. I had also heard from someone living there that it's more like every hour, or generally just whenever it happens. So the way that people experience that is that it essentially disturbs the peace, a place where people are meant to go to be able to sleep without the threat of city sweeps, ends up being a place where there are these inconsistent, knocking. Someone told me a story of people looking inside of their pod while they were in there, and when they confronted them, they said, we're trying to fix something, despite there being nothing really wrong with their pod at all. So it just feels a little bit like, people feel like they're just kind of being watched a little bit more than they would like.
Well, you also obtained a complaint that made its way to the mayor's office. What was that story?
I spoke to someone who filed a complaint through a form on the mayor's website because they didn't know how to properly file a complaint. I should say I didn't talk to anyone who knew how to. No one I talked to knew how to file a complaint through the proper channels. So they said in that complaint that they were surrounded near a disabled bathroom, and employees essentially said, mocked their disability, said they didn't have a disability, and then ultimately exited them from the site when they responded to them. The city sent a statement about that, saying that they acted promptly, ensured that the person was reintegrated into the task site, and continued on their path toward housing. The city said, "We're committed to supporting them through this journey, addressing their needs with care and sensitivity." What I learned after talking with the person who had that experience is that when they got back and they were escorted to their site, the staff member said, "Don't write the mayor again."
Wow. Well, you covered a lot in this second installment of the series on urban alchemy. What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
Yeah, this was settled 2 days after the Clinton Triangle temporary shelter site was opened in Portland. And, you know, kind of one of the things that was raised in the first part of this is how much urban alchemy's public messaging about this is actually aligned with what's happening at the sites. And the public messaging, or the messaging to me when I spoke with urban alchemy, was that that most of these, you know, previous allegations in California and lawsuits were essentially falsified stories. However, there was a clear opportunity there on two separate occasions to actually say that, you know, these lawsuits were settled in whatever way. And so I guess the takeaway here is that there are more questions to be asked, and I guess we'll continue to ask them, because we kind of have a right to know what's going on in these sites that we're paying up to $50 million for.
Where can folks find out more if they're interested?
The best way to read Street Roots is to buy a physical copy from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Appreciate it. That was Jeremiah Hayden, staff reporter at Street Roots, talking with me about his new story. It's the second installment in his series on Portland homeless service contractor Urban Alchemy. The article is titled "Urban Alchemy's Million Dollar Lawsuit." Urban Alchemy settled a $1 million lawsuit days after Portland opened a UA-operated camp in July. The class action suit brought by an employee in California speaks to concerns about the organization's model. More information on that story is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings. You are tuned in to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. If you've enjoyed the KBOO Evening News this year, consider supporting us with a donation. It's very easy to do, and every dollar counts. You can go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Now on to our reflection on the year. KBOO reporter Isabel Charlet has been especially busy these past few months covering protests for a ceasefire in Gaza and the Portland teacher strike. We'll be revisiting some of those pieces now. Here is some of Isabel's reporting on the Portland teacher strike.
Yesterday, thousands of teachers, parents, students, and their allies converged at the PPS district building to show their support for the strike. This is PPS parent Koya Crespin.
Our teachers are fighting for the students' right to clean and safe buildings, smaller class sizes, and more mental health supports. These are not unreasonable demands. Why am I sending my most precious, my most dear, off to schools where the ceilings are falling in and the heat doesn't work? Why am I trusting PPS management when they are essentially spitting in my face, stonewalling our students at the bargaining table?
We have to have our basic physical needs met in order to engage in the complex thought learning requires. This is not possible in a classroom that is 95 to 100 degrees.
That's right.
After writing emails to management and filing OSHA complaints and filing a formal complaint with our principal that included over 70 staff signatures in support of immediate action, after all of that, district management did nothing. We deserve better. Our students deserve better.
I've been an educator now for 22 years, and I have seen the needs of our students go up and up and up. I have seen the demands of our administration on us go up and up and up. And what I have seen is our resources go down and down and down. That ends now.
But it's not just Portland who's showing up to support this strike. Union leaders from across the country have come this week to show their solidarity and share some of their experiences organizing in their own cities. This is the president of the Minneapolis Teachers Union, Marcia Howard.
And you know what I notice when I look at this manufactured crisis that Portland Public Schools claims that you're in? It sounds real, real familiar. But I'm gonna tell you what else is real familiar. A bunch of dedicated educational professionals finally getting up and walking out and holding the line for their students, for these families, and for themselves. Every single student that comes into Portland needs to know that they are cherished. Every single student that comes into Portland needs to know they got a dedicated and fairly compensated educator.
Yeah, I am in the back of a pickup truck with two speakers tied to it with Jackie Dixon, my VP. I'm looking back at a crowd of thousands of community members, teachers, students, kids, heading towards the Burnside Drip Bridge. We're about to take it over. I see signs with board member names and phone numbers because they need to understand the urgency of the moment and not get on a plane to take their Thanksgiving break while 40,000 students sit uncertain about what next week will look like.
And what's your motivation for taking the bridge?
Our motivation is that for one day of an unnecessary strike was one day too long. Going into a fourth week is unconscionable. We do not want to be on strike. We want to be with our students at school, and we need this district to take this bargaining seriously. It has been a mess since the beginning. The trust is gone. They need to accept the agreement that we have come to. I'm just so grateful for this city standing up for our kids and for our teachers. And it chokes me up every time I start thinking about it because we're gonna win the schools our kids need. So,
awesome, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My name's Eric.
And what school do you teach at?
I teach at Beaumont Middle School.
Do you think you could describe, like, what are some of the most significant challenges that you see your students facing?
Mental health supports. The kids who need the mental health supports about the most, they aren't there. So many of our kids are going through times of trauma, and that trauma impacts them adversely, and we as teachers work with them to provide all the supports that we have available. It's never enough.
Those were excerpts of some of Isabel Charlet's reporting on the Portland teacher strike this November. I got the chance to catch up with Isabel to get her perspective on 2023. Isabel, thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Hi, my pleasure.
Well, let's talk first about you. Folks might recognize your voice, but can you give us a little backstory? How long have you been involved at KABU?
Sure. I did a couple years stint volunteering a long time ago, in like 2013. And then I kind of took a break for some years. And then I jumped back into it, I think like a few years ago, and have in spurts since then. And lately, and I guess this past year, I've been more consistent, which has been so fun.
Yeah, we love what you've done. What are some of your favorite things about the news department in general?
I just feel so grateful to KABU for having the chance I've just been able to learn so many skills and gotten to practice so many skills through volunteering with the news department. You know, many years ago, I took interviewing classes and editing classes and field reporting classes, and got to borrow field recording equipment. And it's just really special to be able to have access to all of those resources. And it's just so fun to be able to follow my passions, follow what I'm interested in, and to make stories about that and then get to hear them on the radio.
Well, speaking of passions, what are some of your favorite stories that you've gotten to do over the past year?
Yeah, well, it was so exciting to get to cover the teacher strike here in Portland. And I was thinking actually about one of my most exciting moments reporting from the year just happened a few weeks ago, when there was a big, before the strike was settled, and the Portland Association of Teachers took over the Burnside Bridge in kind of a surprise action. And there were thousands of people marching, and there was a moment where I was up at the front of the march and I had my recording gear with me, and I was like, oh, I want to, who am I going to talk to? And then I saw Angela Bonilla, the president of the union, on the back of a pickup truck, kind of leading the march, just driving along very slowly. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to go talk to Angela while she's riding in the back of that truck. And it was so fun just to go up next to her, and I stuck my mic up in the air, and she was like, hey, and leaned over, and we did the interview as we were kind of walking along, leading this giant march across the bridge. And it was so beautiful and exciting and fun. And so just felt like such, I felt so lucky and to be a part of such a powerful historic moment like that.
I love that description, because, you know, there, it's one thing to hear it, and it's another thing to visualize how it all comes together.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of what I love about reporting and about fields reporting in general, just being out there on the street and trying to see what opportunities pop up, and just, you know, working up the courage to go strike up conversations with people that you maybe wouldn't otherwise. And, you know, having a microphone just is this immediate entry point. And in my experience so far, just, you know, makes people generally just more excited to share. And yeah, I just love having the opportunity to get different people's perspectives on what's going on.
Are there particular issues that you tend to focus on in your reporting?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of, what I love about KBOO, what's cool about it, is because it's volunteer, I really can just kind of go with the flow of what's happening in the moment. So, yeah, I'm definitely have been focused a good amount on what's happening with the teachers union and at Portland Public Schools in general. And part of the reason I'm interested in that is because I'm actually a substitute teacher for PPS. So I'm kind of playing a fun dual role there. And then I also have been interested, I've been covering some of the ceasefire campaign about Israel and Palestine. And that's something that that's an issue that just feels close to my heart. So I'm feel glad to be able to be in touch with local activists and be following that journey here in Portland. Oh, actually, there was a conversation that I had earlier this year with some high school climate justice activists. That was really fun. And that was actually my first in the studio interview that I've done in some years, because since COVID, everything's kind of been remote. So climate change is another one that I feel passionate about and enjoy making stories about.
Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to covering more in 2024?
Well, I definitely want to keep covering what's going on at PPS and all of the unions there, because there's still, you know, lots of negotiating to happen on that front. So I'll definitely keep covering that. There's lots of things that I'm interested in and lots of things that I'm curious about. And part of what I love about volunteering at KBOO is I get to really just be in the moment. And when something pops up on my radar that maybe I knew about before, or maybe, you know, somebody invites me to an event, or I hear about a protest going on, or there's some new campaign that's being started, or an old campaign that's being, you know, that's something that, whatever it is that interests me, that I just love that I have the flexibility to go after that and follow that. So I look forward to the mystery of what's going to be exciting and interesting for me next year.
Much yet to come. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Just that I love KBOO, and I'm just so appreciative to have the opportunity to be a volunteer for the news. And I just so appreciate you, Althea, and all of your hard work to make it happen every day.
Aw, thank you. And thank you for all your great reporting this year. Intrepid reporting by Isabel.
Yeah, thank you.
You are listening to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. We're taking a look back with our reporters on some of their favorite stories from the year. We've just been speaking with KBOO reporter Isabel Charlet. Now let's listen to some more of her reporting from 2023.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for holding this energy in this moment as we are demanding that our elected officials pay attention, don't look away, and call for a ceasefire now. Ceasefire now!
Ceasefire now!
This is what needs to continue to happen. We cannot let our government go on business as usual as a genocide is taking place.
That's right! We are here as Jews because our collective experiences of oppression have been cynically weaponized to justify the oppression of others. We are here as U.S. residents because our tax dollars are used without our consent to fund the continued genocide of Palestinians and theft of Palestinian land.
Activists focused on pressuring Blumenauer because he has expressed concern for the safety of Gazans.